is what I'm going to say and this is how I'm going to behave. But we have this horrible habit in politics of thinking one speech, one article will change everything. And it's not. You know, you might be able to set out the principles, even some of the policies in an article, but you have to then actually go on to deliver that day by day, hour by hour, and frankly, in this media environment, minute by minute. So it needs to be like everything needs to come to first principles.
Yeah.
Now, if those first principles have changed, have shifted, and there is a different way that they are going to run the operation and manage in terms of, you know, I mean, I would say they've already got some quite left wing policy. They just never sort of say, hey, this is a big left wing policy. But, you know, the workers' rights, renters' rights.
Yes.
Yeah, this is left wing policy that he was doing under the pre-reset.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe we'll stop on the pre-reset. But Emma Burnell, Theo Bertram, thank you very much for talking to us at the end of tumultuous week. I have to practice saying that. It's all we have time for, and that's the end for me and this week. It's been great keeping you and you keeping me company on The Times at One. Aisha Hazarika is in from 1 o'clock tomorrow, and Fee Glover and Jane Garvey are here.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Joe. Good afternoon. 2 o'clock. This is Times Radio, and Jane Garvey and Fee Glover are with you until four.
In the next 2 hours, why does the shutdown of an obscure archive threaten the idea of justice in the UK? The Times' George Greenwood will tell us more. Are you fed up with excrement in the rivers? I dare you to answer no to that question. The government says it's cracking down on the problem. We'll hear exactly what it's doing. We'll speak to the ex-priest setting TikTok alight, who says the Catholic Church's rules on celibacy are out of date. And our big guest is the best-selling author Jenny Godfrey on her latest novel.
Yes, it's called The Barbecue at Number 9. It's set on Live Aid Day in 1985, and it's excellent. She's on with us later. Here's the news at 2, Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, Jane. Thank you. Sir Jim Ratcliffe has apologised for his choice of language in saying the UK has been colonised by immigrants. The FA is assessing whether the INEOS founder and Manchester United owner has brought football into disrepute. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has condemned those remarks, but has defended the government investing in INEOS's Grangemouth plant in central Scotland.
What Jim Ratcliffe said was unacceptable. It was disgusting, frankly. But I'm not going to let what Jim Ratcliffe has said determine the future of jobs in Scotland. It is really important that we invest in our industrial base in Scotland and right across the UK.
The billionaire says it is important that he raises the issue of immigration. Lord Billamoria, an entrepreneur who's now on the Independent Commission on Community and Cohesion, told Times Radio the nature of immigration is more important than the raw numbers.
I personally feel you've got to integrate, and I'm proud to have integrated into the UK. I'm not talking about assimilation. I'm talking about integration, where people can still maintain the identity of their roots, their culture, their religion, and then everyone in a cohesive way works together, live together.
Donald Trump's libel case against the BBC will go to trial next February. The president is suing the corporation for $10 billion, or £7.3 billion, over how it edited one of his speeches for a Panorama documentary. The BBC has indicated it will fight the case. The culture secretary says the political chaos surrounding the government is unforgivable. Lisa Nandy, who ran against Keir Starmer for Labour leader in 2020, has called for a change but says the Prime Minister cannot revamp who he is as a person. A court has been told a 13-year-old boy sprayed ant killer in a child's face before stabbing two others at a school in northwest London. The suspect is a British-born UK national who can't be named for legal reasons. It's been revealed the government still has 78 live contracts with Fujitsu, the tech company which created and defended the defective post office accounting system Horizon. The Japanese firm is still getting millions of pounds in taxpayer money, despite its involvement in what's been described as the biggest miscarriage of justice in British history. The government says walking away from those contracts would do serious damage to public services. And a folk singer who lost his voice because of motor neurone disease has performed a new song by using AI to clone his voice.
I don't believe in God, but I believe in me. I believe in all the things that I and you could be.
Patrick Darling recorded himself before his diagnosis at the age of 29 to listen back and adjust his style. Now, those home recordings have helped him sing this new song, which has been entirely written and recorded since he lost his voice. He says technology company 11 Labs recreating his voice has changed his life. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Welcome to Thursday. You know what it is. It's Proud as a Peacock Thursday. Yes, it is here again. So soon we hear you cry, and we can hear your cries. It's 003... No, what is it? 0333 003 2353. Just in a couple of sentences, tell us what you're proud of this week, who you're proud of this week, and you stand a chance of winning £250 from Wickes. Elsewhere in the programme, there is other stuff. We're going to talk about court records and a part of the court that you probably didn't even know existed, but it has been essential in terms of accountability and for reporters to find the right information about who has been processed by the courts. We're going to talk about why the government has decided to shut that down. Hot priest sex, we were billing this as a story we could have done yesterday. It's moved its way into the agenda today. So we do want to find out a little bit more about the reality of celibacy within the Catholic priesthood. The Environment Agency says it's really upped its game with water pollution across the UK. Well, we'll see about that. Vassos Alexander takes apart the Jim Ratcliffe story. It's upset so many people. What feels good in Monaco doesn't look so good in Manchester. Jane Mulkerins will pop in to lift our spirits. And after 3:30...
we have the novelist Jenny Godfrey. She went right to the top of the Sunday Times bestseller charts with her debut novel, which was called The List of Suspicious Things. So she now feels under quite a lot of pressure to do it all again with her second book out today, The Barbecue at Number 9, and it's set on Live Aid Day in a suburban close back in 1985, and I suppose the book, loosely speaking, it is good, by the way, just explores what really goes on behind those squeaky clean net curtains of suburbia. But what were people really thinking and feeling back in the 1980s? It's a great concept, it's a great book, and Jenny's a good woman, and you can hear from her after 3:30 this afternoon.
Most read stories so far today on the Times website.
Well, at number three, it's Lisa Nandy. Chaos engulfing Starmer's government is unforgivable. The Culture Secretary has cast doubt on whether the Prime Minister really can revamp his leadership following the Mandelson scandal. At number two, the world is in peril. AI researchers quit with public warnings. Two employees of OpenAI and Anthropic cited concerns about the future of humanity amid wider resignations in the industry. And the most read piece on the Times website right now, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, Britain has been colonised by immigrants. This is the British billionaire who claims immigration is one of the nation's main problems. But the Prime Minister has condemned his remarks, saying they were offensive and wrong. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need or you can get a digital subscription. Why not go to thetimes.com/subscribe and become a part of thetimes.com, and you'll be thoroughly up to date 24 hours a day.
So we have plenty to get through this afternoon. We hope you can stay with us all of the way through. We're going to start with the court system, which is on the brink of collapse, according to a review by the retired senior judge Sir Brian Leveson, with open, timely justice already under threat. You might be surprised to hear that the place where many of the system's decisions are recorded is being shut down. The Times would agree it's wrong. Today's Thunderer column calls on the government to think again about the closure of this archive, which is called Court's Desk. We can talk to George Greenwood, who's investigations reporter for the paper, who wrote the Thunderer column. Hello, George.
Good afternoon.
So many people will never have heard of Court's Desk. So paint a picture of what it is, what it does.
Sure. So basically, we have a very, very fragmented court system. Records are very difficult to get hold of, very expensive to get hold of. And one solution to some of these problems was this company called Court's Desk. They set up a system whereby they collated court lists and information about court case outcomes from magistrates' courts around the country into a really easily accessible, usable database that journalists, so people who had a right to access that material, already could access, and then allowed us to search across the records to find trends, to find cases we might want to cover, to find case studies for our stories, and also keep up to date on cases that were quite difficult to track from the outside. Now, that has all been shut down by the government. It's not clear why. The government at the dispatch box, the minister, Sarah Sackman, claimed that there was an issue with data protection around how they'd used the material they collected, but it was not serious enough for them to report this to the data commissioner in the UK, the ICO, who regulates this matter. Mm. It is really, really odd and very damaging, because this kind of database actually opened up the courts to many people who would simply not be able to access it, be they reporters or people working very closely on researching court records. It's undermined open justice, I would go far as saying.
Could anybody access it?
So you had to be somebody who had a right to access additional records about the courts, because it did include things such as victims' names and addresses. This is the material you would be given if you were a journalist attending a court. So it was only a licence giving out to journalists or people with a very, very close, for example, academic need to research the system. But the problem is that now we can't access this. Now, to do the equivalent, I would have to set up an email account, get something like 150 different magistrates' courts email sort of round robins every day, have no problems with that, and then also have that running constantly to build up this archive, and then you've missed things. And it's just a complete logistical nightmare compared to what it was before.
Can you give us an example of an investigation you've done or a story that's been written that would have used the archive to get there?
Yeah, I mean, so last year we were looking at this crisis in the government's tagging system. So for listeners who don't recall, the contract for government tagging of people on things like suspended sentences was not going well. There were long delays between criminals having a sentence requiring a tag or a order requiring a tag and that tag actually being fitted. Now, Courts Desk was great for this because what we could do is search across all these records and look for cases that really highlighted really stark examples of the harms that were coming from this failure to get people tagged. People, you know, who had been stalkers, for example, who were supposed to be on a tag, weren't, and then had gone out and targeted their victims. But that kind of reporting that we used Court Desk for is now impossible. So it's utterly farcical for the minister to come out and say that journalist access to information has not been affected. It has. That is one example of where it's a report that I could not have done today, that I could have done when Court Desk was running.
Is there any validity in the argument that this has made individuals vulnerable, though, that AI might have been involved that could have breached data protection? Because that should worry all of us, shouldn't it?
Of course. And if that was what had happened, I think it's something that the government would have been right to raise with the company. Not, I don't necessarily agree that it was something they should shut off their access for. But my understanding of what the AI tool the company was using was actually to automate the removal of victim data from the records so that an inexperienced journalist didn't accidentally release the name or address of a victim. Actually, what they were doing was trying to make it safer for victims. And because the word AI was involved, it seems the government has freaked out, and that may explain why it's taken this decision. But, you know, I think we need to be very careful with our data protection measures go forward. But I don't believe that's exactly what's happened in this case. And this overreaction means that journalists and the public at large are going to be made poorer for it.
If you wanted to go down what can sometimes be the rabbit hole of conspiracy theories, would you arrive quite quickly at a position that was a government that simply didn't want to have such open justice?
I mean, I think it's more likely to be cock-up rather than conspiracy. But I think the problem the government has is if you search Courts Desks online now, you will find all these conspiracy theories about why they've shut it down. And those are spreading. That misinformation has come directly from their lack of transparency, because people, especially extremists, will jump into an issue where there's not enough transparency and create their own narratives. By not being transparent, they've actually created a problem of misinformation For everybody. I personally think it's more likely that there's been some decision that is a bit awkward, or there's something that's making life slightly difficult for someone in government, so they decided not to do it anymore, but did not appreciate that something like this is not just a nice to have. It's actually crucially important for a democratic society to have proper access to the courts. And, you know, while in theory I could get the same information about one case from a court, and that's the basis of the government's declaration on this, in practice, I can't make access requests for information or use that information if I don't know where it is in the first place. And cutting out of the system makes it monumentally difficult to track those cases. It's just, it's ridiculous.
And have you had any kind of feedback from exactly those criticisms that you've made?
So in terms of...
From the government.
They claim, you know, that they're trying to protect victims' data protection rights. But again, my concern is I don't think they quite understand what the problem was in this case. And I'm just concerned they've reacted without thinking about it and caused damage every day we don't have access to this archive to both open justice and also the ability of press to hold the government to account. When we are in a courts crisis and things are going wrong in the courts, you know, this will provide additional transparency of some of those issues as well.
What's going to be the worst case scenario because of this?
The worst case scenario is we miss trends in serious offences, miscarriages of justice. I mean, we've all talked about the post office scandal for many years as something where we had large numbers of wrongful prosecutions. What systems like Courts Desk allow is for you to look across cases, find patterns. You know, if a certain kind of person is being prosecuted for a certain kind of offence and you see that pattern repeated across the country, you can actually identify that early and prevent harm from happening. The risk of this is that journalists can't look at this information. They miss this because they can't track the awful system that exists at the moment. And really serious harm in the courts, miscarriages of justice continue because no one can look at it across the piece and say, that's something that's going wrong. You know, it could really hurt people not having access to the system.
So we're talking about it now. You've written a fantastic column in the Times today. But, George, you know the problem. This isn't the spiciest, sexiest area of injustice within the legal system, is it? So, I mean, it's hard. I'd never heard of Courts Desk before myself. You know, people who are outside of journalism and the courts probably haven't heard of it either. Where do you get that kind of head of steam that might progress your call for something like this to be reinstated?
I think sometimes you just have to explain to people and trust your audience to understand that it might not be, you know, a pee in the pound on tax, for example, as a political issue. But actually, this whole issue of transparency is crucially important to have the society we like to live in. As a journalist, I'm very lucky to work in the UK. Many of my international colleagues face threats every day, face, you know, physical threats to their existence. But actually in our country, unless we fight for our rights, unless we fight for access to this stuff, we're very much at risk of losing these rights. There's no right for us to have this kind of society. If we like having an open society, we have to fight for it every day. And I think explaining to people what the risks are of not fighting for issues like this, how it can affect their ability to live the lives they want, I think that's the way of getting people riled up, as you say, about such an issue. And I just think we need to, you know, we say it's a boring issue, but I think let's just go out and explain it to people and actually try and explain to them why it's something they should care about and hope that they understand from our point of view, those who are in this system, quite how frustrating it is where our rights of access are undermined.
Sure. I don't think it's boring at all. I wasn't meaning to imply
no,
that.
No, I know what you're saying. It's not necessarily
it's a process thing, you know, which sometimes, you know, does struggle to make headlines. But you're absolutely right to say if we hit worst case scenario, boy, we'd have headlines about it. George, thank you very much indeed. People can go on the Times app and take a read of the Thunderer column by George Greenwood.
It is 17 minutes past 2, Times Radio, and next we're talking about the future of celibacy in the Roman Catholic Church. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. You can explore all the sale offers at wickes.co.uk or visit your local Wickes store.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
We'll bring you the very latest from Brussels as NATO defence ministers meet to discuss how to bolster security in the Arctic. The communications consultant Liam Deacon and the author and columnist Peter Hitchens join us to discuss the biggest stories of the day. And our newsmaker interview is George Finch. He became the youngest council leader in the UK last year when he was elected to lead Warwickshire County Council for Reform. We'll hear how he's finding the challenge of local politics.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Right now, the kitchen and bathroom sale is on. There are options to suit every budget and every home. Browse all the kitchen and bathroom sale offers at wix.co.uk.
Yes, and you can tell us about your proud as a peacock moments between now and the end of the programme. 0333 003 2353 or Jane and Fee at times.radio on the email. And you could be the lucky winner of a £250 Wix voucher. We are giving another one away before the end of the programme. Now, if you're a rugby fan, you'll be enjoying the Six Nations, I've no doubt. This year, the final round will be explosive with rivals England and France going head-to-head in the last game of the competition. Now, there's a live event you can attend just ahead of that match. It's on the 9th of March. Courtney Laws, Serge Betson and Alfie Reynolds, hosts of the Times rugby podcast The Ruck, will compare notes on the biggest moments of this year's tournament. If you'd like to book a ticket, head to thetimes.com/events. That rugby podcast, The Ruck, is very similar to Off Air with Jane and Fee. We often discuss scrumming down, don't we?
We certainly
and much,
do.
Much else besides.
Yep. We've got the big thighs as well.
We've certainly got those. I don't know where to go with that. Right. Our podcast is Off Air with Jane and Fee. There's almost no rugby in it at all. I don't think there ever has been. We're moving on seamlessly now to our next topic on this live radio programme. Is celibacy sustainable for the Catholic Church?
Come on. Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about
sex. It's salt and pepper, isn't it?
It is.
How could we forget? We are going to talk about sex now with Don Alberto Ravignani. Now, Alberto was a priest. He gained hundreds of thousands of fans on social media with his videos in which he would work out, go to raves and generally document his life as a young priest in Milan. So what's changed? Well, he's given up the priesthood because of his frustration with the celibacy policy. Welcome to the programme. How are you?
Hi, everybody. I'm fine, thanks. It's a very complicated period of my life, but I'm okay.
Good. I imagine it is complicated, actually. There are some very serious issues here. You obviously felt a calling and you've had to leave the priesthood. So did it take you a long period of time to work up to that?
Yes, I took more or less 2 years. The last 2 years of my life have been marked by doubts and questions, and I talked a lot with a lot of people to understand whether to continue being a priest or not, and I decided to stop being a priest and to keep on living my mission and my vocation in another way.
I see. So it isn't the faith that you've lost?
No, not at all.
And can you explain why you've kept the faith but lost that Catholic mission?
Yes, well, my faith has changed a lot, but I haven't lost it. My problem was about the conditions of being a priest. I decided to stop being a priest and I decided to exit the boundaries of this kind of life because I realized that they were not too harsh for me.
Yeah.
For my life, for my ideas of living the gospel nowadays. In somehow, I would say that they are out of this time. It is difficult to... society nowadays is very different from the past. It's no more a Christian society. So religion, in my opinion, has to change a bit. And according to this, also being a priest, the life of priest should change in order to preach the gospel in a better way.
Right, OK. Can you explain Catholic thinking on celibacy? I mean, I'm not a Catholic, but I would assume that the logic is that if you are a celibate priest, and of course only a man in the Catholic Church, you are able to dedicate your life to your parishioners. Is that the thinking?
Yes, that's a more practical reason, but it's not the only one. There are theological reasons too, connected with the life of Jesus. He was a celibate man, and as a priest, a priest should be somehow like Jesus, and he was celibate, and so we should be celibate too. And there are also reasons connected to waiting the eternal life, where marriages will be no more. But in my opinion, the most important reason is that being a celibate allows you to be more free to live your life, to give your life to other people.
Right. But you did live that way, and you discovered that you weren't free.
Yes, not at all, because I, as a celibate man, I couldn't live authentically my humanity, my sexuality. I could not have any kind of relationship, love affairs, I mean, with other people. And I realized that being a celibate man is not only the only way that I could live my faith and my vocation. I know a lot of people who are married, who are not priests, and maybe they have more faith than me, and maybe they are more free to give their life to people. Maybe they are more possibilities to create things, projects, and missions for a better society.
Why do you think the Catholic Church clings to this rule, when other Christian churches do allow their priests and ministers to marry and have relationships?
Yes, it's a tradition of the Catholic Church. Well, the Catholic Church said that priests must be celibate from 1,000 years. That is this rule. And in my opinion, the problem is that the chastity of priests is connected with the power. The power in the Catholic Church is held by the clergy, and the clergy is made of celibate people. If church should delete this rule, I think it would be a problem to hold the power as well.
Okay. I'm just trying to think of the idea of a pope with a partner. I don't know why, for some reason, the notion of a pope and his partner, could be female, might not necessarily be, moving in to St. Peter's and making a life there. Do you think it honestly could happen?
I don't know. It's something like a film now.
Yes.
It's a fantasy film.
Yeah.
But I would say the most powerful people in the world are married. I mean, and having a family is not an obstacle to live the responsibility of a nation, of other things.
Sure. I mean, you had made quite a name for yourself on social media. And you were, you know, you put images out of you're in the gym. You're living a very normal young man's life, basically. You also did say that you had written sermons with the aid of ChatGPT. Did you get into trouble for all that?
No. Well, I think everybody should use ChatGPT nowadays because it's an instrument. It can help a lot. I've been helped a lot during my ministry. I think it can help because it could allow priests to create better sermons, to preach in a more comprehensible way in order to understand what especially young people need to listen. Yeah. But
we also, and we've, this conversation has been sort of relatively lighthearted, although I understand there are some serious issues here. But what we can't ignore is the fact that the Catholic Church, like many other churches, I should say, has been riddled with accusations of abuse of children. And in many cases, some people would link that to these rules around only men in the priesthood and the idea that they have to be celibate. What do you think about that?
I think that this problem is a very big issue for the Catholic Church. But in my opinion, these episodes of abuse and cannot be just seen as responsibilities of the people who made these things. I think they are symptoms of a bigger and deeper problem. Well, maybe we can talk about something like an illness of the church, and these abuses are just the symptoms, and the illness is connected with the power. Because abuses and child abuses are expressions of a very bad use of the power the priests have. And well, and this power is, kept, is conserved by the rule of the celibacy.
Yeah.
All the priests are a celibacy. The celibate is a rule that allows the church to hold the power in the hands of the clergy. And sometimes priests use this power in a very bad way.
Well, they certainly have had done exactly that. That's true. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Don Alberto Ravignani, who was a very, very successful social media Italian Catholic priest, and he has walked away from his ministry in Milan because of the policy on celibacy.
Mark from Sussex said, St. Peter was married. Celibacy for Catholic priests was introduced centuries after Jesus. It wasn't Jesus's teaching, and it's also not in the Bible. Church leaders are instructed to be the husband of only one wife in the Bible. So at what point did the Catholic Church decide that priests couldn't be married? I'd be interested to know. I'm outside that faith myself.
And when, after the Reformation, when Henry VIII organised the Church of England, or the Church of England came to be, was it an immediate rule that Church of England ministers could be married, or were they also celibate to start with?
Well, Ryan has just informed me that it's in the 11th and 12th century that Catholic priests could not be married. It was deemed by the Church, and I think he's busy looking up that one for us as well.
God, he does a lot, doesn't he?
He certainly does. And I think he's very unfairly tarred with the moniker of the man who presses the buttons. He does way more than just press the buttons.
As we both know, he does a lot more than that.
Together with Wix, we want to know your proudest moment of the week to be in with a chance to win a £250 Wix voucher in our Wix Peacock Awards. Incoming from Andy, I'd like to nominate myself this week, please. I'm proud as a peacock. I finally got round to sorting out my wardrobe, taking all of my old clothes to the local charity shop. Being a bit of a hoarder, it's a job I've been putting off for ages. You're in the pile, Andy. And Ian, who I think is quite a regular listener from Rain Park, he's finally got to the gym. Hasn't been for years. The girl who swiped me in on reception shouted out, "You haven't been since 2019. You must have more money than sense." That's quite a long time. Anyway, gentle 20 lengths, says Ian. It was so good. Now I'm back on the looking after myself treadmill after a few years of genuinely bad living. Do I win the prize? Well, you're in the pot. We'll decide the prize just before 4 o'clock. You can send us a WhatsApp, 0333 003 2353, or email janeandfee@times.radio. And don't forget, the Wix kitchen and bathroom sale is on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
And next on Times Radio, what is being done about our pollution-filled rivers? Here are the headlines a little bit late. Here's Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Sir Jim Ratcliffe has apologised for his choice of words when he said the UK has been colonised by immigrants. The FA is assessing whether the INEOS founder and Manchester United owner has brought football into disrepute. Businessman and former Crystal Palace chairman Simon Jordan doesn't think the FA should be involved, though.
He's not done it at a football forum. He's not done it in a football fraternity. He's talking at a business conference. But the FA getting themselves involved and suggesting he's brought the game into disrepute is just laughable. Sorry. Look, the reality of it is he's entitled to freedom of speech. He is a free individual. He may well be the part shareholder of Man United, and I don't agree with his choice of words. But the fact of the matter is, he is allowed to say or have an opinion.
Downing Street says it's right that Sir Jim Ratcliffe has apologised. A judge in Florida has rejected the BBC's application to block Donald Trump's $10 billion Panorama libel case. The two-week trial has been set for next February. The corporation has previously suggested it will fight the case. The Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, has called the chaos surrounding the government unforgivable. She's also cast doubt on whether the Prime Minister can reinvent his premiership, saying you can't revamp a person. And a paedophile who worked in a nursery where he sexually abused and secretly filmed children has been described as every parent's worst nightmare. Vincent Chan is facing life behind bars after admitting 56 offences, including child sexual abuse. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Summer is calling. Book early for your trip to Turkey and get the most out of your holiday. Visit GoTurkey.com now and discover unforgettable experiences. Plan your summer getaway to Turkey today.
Daryl Morris brings you a first look at the Sunday Times front page splash every Saturday night from 10:30.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Ready to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom? If you'd like a personalised design, the Wix free design service can guide you through the whole process, including a free home measure. Book today at wix.co.uk.
Got quite a few theories on celibacy. Martina says, I believe celibacy was introduced to the church partly for financial reasons, to prevent priests leaving any wealth to their children, but to the church instead. Of course I may be wrong, said Martina modestly. Oh, just have faith.
Well, quite a few people have said the same thing. It really has been about property and inheritance, right, rather than anything of a more kind of profound nature. And a couple of you basically want to say that Fleabag just wouldn't have been as good if we'd followed different rules in the church.
So it would have ruined the plot of Fleabag. Well, that's very important.
And it is.
The Lord Almighty knew Fleabag was coming, so invented the rule. Right. John Pienaar mercifully joins us to discuss his programme from 4 o'clock. What have you got today, John?
So, talking about the Jim Ratcliffe story, which keeps on building up, the walls are closing in, rather. The FA Football Association is having an inquiry into what he said. Should there be a charge of bringing the game into disrepute? You've seen the way the rows have been running. You've seen his apology for what he said last night. If you can call it an apology. I think in politics you call it a non-apology apology. If someone was offended by what I said, I'm sorry that you were offended. That's not quite saying I take back what I said. Was it offensive? Yeah, it was offensive. I mean, I was pretty seriously offended when I heard what I heard of the idea of hearing migrants, just migrants, as it were, described as essentially a harm to this country, a drain on the economy and on public services. Look, my family came to this country in the middle, early 1950s, and I'm here, and my kids are here. I've got a grandson here. We all seem to be under the same heading, really, of migrants. I'm broadly suggested that we're not really doing much good for the country. That's the breadth and the depth, yeah, of the insult that we got.
There was a real negativity about what he said.
Yeah, I mean, and there'll be an awful lot of people who agree with him. I mean, you know, not just of a certain age, but certainly of a certain age, in the crowd at Manchester United, his club, apart from anywhere else. So, yeah, so we're going to be talking about that. But I'm also, in a way, I would have been sort of sorry if he had given a full apology, because it wouldn't have been remotely sincere. And it would have happened because he'd been driven to it, possibly by the corporate interest behind him, the United Football Club, and other kinds of pressure. He said what he thought, as offensive as it was to me, and no doubt to a lot of other people. There will be those who agree. What I think is just basically true, if someone like him, or anyone, says a thing like that, they've got to expect some comeback. They've got to expect to be criticised for it. They've got to expect a really serious row if they're in a public position. And that is what's happening now.
I don't know all that much about Mr. Ratcliffe, but he does have form, shall we say, doesn't
he? Yeah, he's an outspoken guy from all we hear. I haven't had a huge amount of knowledge of him before this. But someone like our colleague Dominic O'Connell says, look, you're right, what you just said is true. He was a leading Brexiteer, and there are those who argue that there you are a leading Brexiteer and you're a tax exile in
Monaco. I mean, that's the bit that sticks to my craw.
I mean, you can argue all of that through, and people are definitely doing that. But I just think, there's an awful lot of layer and depth and nuance to this argument than what we heard from this guy last night, and it was all wrapped up in such embarrassingly false information. His data about migration was just so wildly wrong. But there's an argument there, and his, if you can call them concerns, are shared by a lot of people, and they need to be engaged with, but on a rational level, on the basis of facts.
Thank you, John. More from John Pienaar here on Times Radio between 4 o'clock and 7.
It's 22 minutes to 3. Outrage at Britain's excrement-filled waterways is universal, with the Times' Clean It Up campaign highlighting the worst examples. Public anger has seen executives at water companies placed under so-called citizens' arrest by protesters, but bills continue to rise. The government says it is cracking down on pollution, and it's set up what it calls the largest ever enforcement team to do that. Let's talk to Helen Wakenham, who is Director of Water for the Environment Agency. Helen Wakenham, very good afternoon from us. Just outline to us in very plain and simple terms exactly what this enforcement team will do and how it's different from what has gone before.
Good afternoon, everyone. So what we're announcing is our biggest ever water enforcement workforce. Over the past couple of years, we've been expanding the number of inspections we do of water industry facilities. So 4,000 in the last business year. We're aiming for 10,000 this business year. What we're doing by expanding our enforcement service to match is to make sure that where we do find problems at water industry sites, we can hold the water industry to account. So those people will be out on the ground visiting sites. They'll be gathering evidence. They'll be building cases for us to take forward to prosecution. We've also got other sort of tools in our arsenal. So we have things called enforcement undertakings. So rather than taking companies to court, they can make an enforcement undertaking that actually returns the value of that, the fines, back to the local environment. So working with local wildlife and rivers trust, for example, to return money to the environment.
Okay.
And it's really important because as you mentioned, right, it's disgusting. Nobody likes to see sewage on beaches and in rivers. And this sort of tougher regime will bring water companies to account and bring them to compliance, which is what we want to see.
How do you think all of that lands with the many people who will be listening to this thinking, I've called the Environment Agency, I've had sewage bubbling up in my garden, I've tried to take my kids swimming on a beach, nothing happened because of it. Does this new enforcement team, the largest ever, really hope to answer every call and to deal with every complaint? Because the statistics are very bad, aren't they? Data obtained by the BBC showed that the Environment Agency went to just 13 of all of the pollution incidents that were reported to it in 2024. I mean, that is low. You couldn't really get worse than that, could you, Helen?
I don't recognise the number. The Environment Agency responds to every report of pollution where we see reports of serious pollution incidents, we aim to attend every one. So I don't recognise the number. I do understand the anger and frustration and this build-up of our service, this more people. I'll now have 700 people working on water industry regulation alone. That will help us to tackle those pollution incidents. We will be everywhere. We will be looking at what the water industry is doing. When we visit their sites in 2024-25, we visited 4,000 sites. There was something wrong at 1,000 of those sites. This additional workforce will help us to make sure that what's wrong at those sites gets put right. Now, some of it is quite simple stuff. It's poor maintenance on those sites, broken screens, broken pumps. Some of it requires infrastructure. And that does take some time to deliver. But again, being out on those sites, gathering that evidence makes the case for future investment. Right. So we really do expect to see things change.
Would you accept that there is still a very kind of weak spot in the enforcement that you can actually then make on the water companies?
Well, where we've been is, for the Environment Agency, is enforcement requiring a criminal level of proof. That's a very high bar and it takes quite a long time to gather the evidence for that. We've got more money for enforcement through the Water Special Measures Act. And the next thing that's coming is government has just consulted on civil penalties and automatic penalties for water industry offences. That means that the small stuff, things that might happen every day, are dealt with automatically, and that gives us more capacity to enforce on the big stuff. But ultimately, what we want to do is for the water industry to comply with the law. Taking enforcement action kind of means that the horse has bolted, and what we're expecting is that the transparency that this new work gives us will encourage the companies into compliance and stop these problems happening in the first place.
Helen, I just wanted to jump in there because, you know, I have absolutely no doubt that you would like to see this situation improved, but we know that so many people have been calling for so long for the situation to improve. And I just wonder whether it's possible for you to tell us, you know, which bits that you need more of. I mean, you've made that very interesting distinction between the kind of civil enforcement powers you have and criminal enforcement powers that you have. The problem is still going to be the same for the person who's suffering, isn't it?
Well, ultimately, we'd expect that the enforcement action that we take and the visibility of what's going on in the water industry will drive better performance. And we can already see it. We can see the behaviours of the water industry shifting. So we can see increased asset maintenance, for example, really rapid investigations of problems we see on site. We can see them planning for compliance. All of that will help to reduce the level of problems that they're having. So we do expect to see a shift. And if anybody wants to see the action that we're taking, every time we visit a site, we produce a report which is available online, so people can go online on gov.uk and see exactly what we're doing and what we're asking the water industry to do.
Have you got the money and the resources that you need?
I've been involved in water quality and water industry regulation for a long time. We've never had more resources, so we've now got £153 million a year in a combination of charges on the water industry and enforcement levy. I've got 700 people working on regulation of the water industry, a further 200 people looking at water regulation for other sectors. So I think we're very well resourced. What we need to keep working on is turning inspection effort into real intelligence, which means we focus on the right things and we make much better use of digital tools and all the data that we've got to make sure that we're acting in the right places. And the all important thing is that everybody can see us doing that, including the water companies. And that's what will drive the improvement in their performance.
Some customers have found themselves in a position where they believe that the water companies are being asked to kind of mark their own homework. If they make a complaint, if they report an incident, it's the water company that's been able to dictate whether or not there is a decent reason for that incident. So that's about storm release and all of those kind of things. Are you saying that today a bigger enforcement team means that that doesn't happen anymore? Are you taking more of the power away from the water companies with this?
There have been some misconceptions about water companies marking their own homework. The way our performance assessment of them works is that we expect them to report pollution incidents to us before anybody else does. So that's them self-reporting, is them telling us very quickly that there's a problem. And we want them to continue to do that. But certainly the enforcement effort will make sure that we can see what the water industry is doing. And as we go forward, there's much more emphasis on water industry data being made available in near real time. And that means that everybody else and see what's going on as well.
You see that?
Yes, as we go forward, there's lots more information for everyone.
Sure, but Helen, that does just still seem mad, doesn't it? I mean, these water companies, so many of them have proved to be, you know, really not fit for purpose. The idea that it is still up to them to report when something is going wrong just seems illogical.
Well, I think if something happens in the environment, we want them to tell us really quickly. Somebody else might see it first. We expect them to be on it. So I think it's a good thing that the water industry do report to us something that otherwise might not be seen. There is lots more telemetry. Every single storm overflow in England is now monitored 24/7. All of that gives us a huge amount of information to go on in terms of understanding what's going on in the system. And there's so much scrutiny on the water industry. They are under real pressure to comply with the law, and we'll be watching to make sure that they do.
It's a big job. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Well, it is, isn't it? Thank you for your time this afternoon. That's Helen Wakeham, who's Director of Water for the Environment Agency.
Some cracking stuff, as ever, in the Times magazine this weekend. We will explore it in some detail in a moment with Jane Mulcairns. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wicks, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Alexis Conran on Times Radio with Wild Frontiers Travel. Go beyond the headlines and explore the human experiences at the heart of the week's news agenda with well-informed debate and thoughtful insight, tailor-made for anyone looking to broaden their horizons, not follow the herd.
Plus, get my expertly curated guide to the best the weekend has to offer, whether you're staying in or looking for adventure.
This Saturday afternoon from 1 on Times Radio with Wild Frontiers. Never stop seeking with Wild Frontiers Travel.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Chase is the digital bank that gives you 1% cash back on groceries.
So can I get cash back on cake mix?
Indeed.
And icing?
Yep.
And sprinkles?
Sure.
And candles?
Yeah, and you can turn all that cash back into a nice birthday treat.
How do you know it's my birthday?
Just a hunch. Get 1% cash back on groceries, fuel and everyday transport when you spend with Chase. Search Chase Bank. 18 plus UK residents. 1% cash back on this debit card spending for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Eligibility and exceptions apply. May be changed or withdrawn.
Experience award-winning itineraries from aboard small, luxurious ships with Oceania Cruises. Discover the finest cuisine at sea and exquisitely crafted dining experiences. Enjoy gourmet specialty restaurants and open seat dining at no additional cost. With over 600 destinations to choose from, explore the world with Oceania Cruises. Visit OceaniaCruises.com or your travel agent.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It's Proud as a Peacock Thursday. Let's have a couple of peacocks. This is Alison, Jane and Fee. Please could I nominate myself. My daughter, who's recently passed her driving test, picked me up from work last night. I'm so proud of her, but I'm even prouder of me as I managed to keep my criticism to myself. I've got to say, that's an unforgettable journey, the first one you make with somebody you've given birth to behind the wheel. It's not easy. And Linda says, the reason that I'm proud is that I'm in hospital. I've been in hospital, followed by rehab since New Year's Day. And most of that time, says Linda, I've been flat on my back. However, I've been told I will be allowed home early next week. Well, I hope that happens for you, Linda. And thank you very much for entering. Keep them coming. 0333 003 2353. So, Jane Mulcairns with News of the Times magazine. Can we start with something? It's so serious and it's so depressing. And this is a fantastic piece that everybody should read. But God, it chills your blood, by Daniel Finkelstein.
Yeah, it is, as you say, a tough read and a really horrifying one, but it's resonant of something you were talking about just yesterday on the show with Zach Goldsmith, the totally terrifying explosion of anti-Semitism in this country and globally. So just to give you background to the piece, the brilliant Times writer and columnist Danny Finkelstein wrote a really personal and very pertinent book about his parents a couple of years ago. It's called Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad.
Everyone should read that as
it's
well.
It's incredible book. His mum survived Bergen-Belsen. Some of his grandparents died, however. His dad's family were taken to a Siberian gulag. And then it's this really joyful story of them coming to London and finding peace and stability in North London, around the corner, as he says, from Brent Cross. And his mum ended up doing an awful lot of talks about what she'd been through. specifically so that it would never happen again, so that it would always be remembered. And Danny's piece in the magazine today shows just how far we are from that being the case. Danny ended up getting embroiled in a kind of interesting sequence of events. There's a right-wing YouTuber called Nick Fuentes.
He's by some margin the most objectionable twerp I've ever come across.
Yeah, you won't hear any objection from me on that.
He was
horrifying.
He's awful. Louis Theroux interviewed him, which is when I first came across him a couple of years ago. Anyway,
he's unashamed in his support for Hitler. Openly. And he's become really quite prominent in America, terrifyingly. Tucker Carlson had him on his show, and in response to that, Piers Morgan challenged him to come on his show. And Danny Finkelstein offered Piers Morgan some sort of help with, you know, his pushback against Fuentes. And as part of that, he made a video about his story and his parents. And then on Piers Morgan's show, Fuentes mocked him, started talking about how British people will have slang for the Holocaust, started calling it the Holly. And as a result of what Nick Fuentes did and said on that show, Danny Finkelstein has been inundated and bombarded with the most horrific anti-Semitic messages and memes. I mean, it's hard to even say this stuff on air, but things about, like, your dad is a lampshade, your mum is a bar of soap, they've made memes of these things, they send him pictures of these things. He has phone calls and text messages directly to him about all of this stuff. And he says it has slowed down in the months since, but it hasn't stopped at all. And as he wrote this, he said, you know, only yesterday he got messages with someone, with an AI-generated Hitler doing the singing, an AI account being set up called I Love Gas Chambers. I mean, the stuff is just, it's hideous. He's tried arguing with them, but it doesn't work, as
you
he
can't,
says.
You cannot reason with
them. You can't reason with someone who calls the Holocaust the Holly. He says they're just beyond reason. So it's a really important piece, I think, to read. And as you say, Jane, the book. And it is beyond depressing. But what I love about this piece is that Danny's take isn't depressing and his approach isn't depressing, and that's really important. He says that his parents would totally have agreed with his approach, which is to confront it all, not to shy away from it all. And they would have found it upsetting, he says, particularly because they really believed in young people and they really believed in America as two very positive forces. And a lot of this pushback seems to be coming from America and from young people. But he says the important thing is that they were never complacent. They had a sense of proportion and they weren't going to live their life as victims, despite everything that has happened to them. And he says they wouldn't want him to either, and he definitely won't. I also think this won't be the last piece that Danny writes on this subject, because I think it just continues to get more horrifying.
Yeah, and as we move further and further away from the events of the Holocaust, it becomes even more significant that we actually, we discuss what happened, we attempt to understand why it happened, and we educate our young people about how it must never ever happen again.
Absolutely.
But
yeah.
God, it is a tough,
it's bleak.
Tough read.
Yeah. Also, just to say, Danny has recorded an episode of the Story podcast about it, in his words, reading this piece. So if you want to listen to it, that will be airing from Saturday.
Okay, you'll find that where you get your podcasts.
All your good podcasts.
Now, Chris Hemsworth.
This is much more cheerful.
Well, he's an attractive actor, noted for playing, is it Thor?
Yes, Jane, an actual god.
An actual god. but actually, this interview is not without its more serious aspects.
No, absolutely. And I think, I mean, what more could you want for Valentine's Day morning than Chris Hemsworth on the cover of your Times magazine?
Oh, yeah, it's Valentine's morning.
It's Valentine's morning. He's a gift to everyone.
It looks like the only person who's got any Valentine's in the office is Rod Little. I did spot a couple of cards on the side. Is it you, Finn?
Who are they from?
No. Well, you know what I said when you asked me that in the office, but I can't repeat it on air.
Carry on, Jane.
Will Pavia has met Chris Hemsworth in New York, and it's a very, very funny interview. Chris Hemsworth, 6'3", 16 stone, plays a god, gives Will fitness and workout and diet advice, which is several paragraphs of great humour.
I like that bit.
Really good. But it is also, as you say, it's got real depth to it. Chris Hemsworth, who is known for sort of being an action man and having, you know, biceps like hams, he actually shot this documentary series with that Darren Aronofsky, who made Black Swan. It was all about longevity. And the idea was that, you know, it would be sort of, you know, this perfect specimen of manhood talking about longevity. And actually, as part of this filming, he did some gene tests and he found that he was quite at high risk of developing Alzheimer's. And he talked to his dad about it, and his dad was very reassuring and said, don't worry, mate, we'll figure it out. And then a few years later, his dad himself was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And Chris just talks so movingly about his relationship with his dad and how they are coping with his dad's Alzheimer's. And this really got me, actually, when I was reading it, that Chris has this approach of keeping on asking his dad questions that he knows the answer to, but to make his dad feel like he's still coming to him with advice. Right. And he just sounds like such a gentle man. And he talks about, you know, that moment when it flips and your parents have always looked after you, but you're now the one looking after them. And he says his goal is just to make his dad feel comfortable and safe the way that he did with him and his three brothers when they were kids. It's a really beautiful read.
Yeah.
And the pictures are quite nice too.
Right, well, that's neither here nor there. Also featuring in the magazine is David Miliband.
Yes. Now, do you like those pictures?
I do like, what can I say? Of course I like those pictures. David is the brother of Ed, and David has a significant job, doesn't he? I mean,
yes.
Quite an important role he's got. Remind us again he does.
I'm going for the actual title now, Joan, because you've challenged me to find it.
It's the big, they're not quite called Saviours of the World, but it's not...
it's not actually Saviours of the World.
It's not far off that.
International Rescue.
That's it.
International Rescue. Thank you, Fee. And he's International Rescue Committee. Yeah. He is well remunerated for that. He does earn $1.2 million a year for being head of that. But I'm sure he's very busy.
Oh, no.
Important. But it's also maybe why he hasn't come back to rescue the Labour Party. could be one of the reasons.
That question is put to him. And indeed, of course, he's asked whether he and his brother Ed are friends again. And that, it doesn't sound as though...
he says, I saw him not so long ago at an event. I mean, you know, my brother can be a bit useless too. I was texting him last night because he hadn't told me about the family villa that we're all apparently going to in France. But, you know, I wouldn't say, oh, yeah, I saw my brother at an event, what, his own 50th?
But you and your brother didn't sort of fall out.
We didn't
over
go
the
head to head to run a country. No, it's true. Absolutely. No. My brother will probably win that as well.
Oh, don't even suggest it. Right. Jane, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
A lot of very important and interesting stuff in the Times magazine on Saturday.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It is now 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Coming up, Donald Trump seems to have escaped any political damage from the latest Epstein files. But the Times' Katie Balls will tell us why some of his team are starting to feel the heat. The FA is investigating the Manchester United co-owner Sir Jim Ratcliffe for his comments about immigrants. Vassos Alexander will bring us the very latest on that story. And sit back and relax. After 3:30, our big interview is with best-selling novelist Jenny Godfrey on her new book. First, it's the news with Tom Noonan.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Sir Jim Ratcliffe has apologised for his choice of language when he said the UK has been colonised by immigrants. The FA says it will look into the INEOS founder's remarks, given his part ownership of Manchester United, and the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has called them disgusting.
Jim Ratcliffe can speak for himself, but the comments that he made yesterday were unacceptable. Our country benefits hugely from its diversity. We see that in our businesses, we see that in our universities, we see that in our cultural life, and we are richer because of the diversity of our country.
Sir Jim Ratcliffe says it's important that he raises the issue of immigration. A judge in Florida has dismissed the BBC's bid to block Donald Trump's $10 billion libel case. They've set the trial for next February. It's over how Panorama edited the president's speech before the January 6th Capitol riot. The BBC's director general and head of news resigned over that, but the corporation insists it will fight the case. A paedophile nursery worker who committed 56 offences, including child sexual abuse, has been jailed for 18 years. Vincent Chan molested girls aged 2 to 4 while working in northwest London and took videos of schoolgirls in a previous job at a primary school. Judge John Dodd says a life sentence is not appropriate, but says no punishment can cure the harm he's caused.
Whilst at the nursery, you had the opportunity to carry out actual sexual abuse upon victims too young and helpless to stop you, and too young to alert anyone as to what you were doing. They were defenceless.
Chan has also admitted upskirting and filming women undressing in their bedrooms. The Culture Secretary says the political chaos surrounding the government is unforgivable. Lisa Nandy, who ran against the Keir Starmer for leader in 2020, has called for change, but says of the Prime Minister, you can't revamp a person. She told Times Radio a number of people in Labour and in government are trying to keep women down.
And almost all of the senior women in the Labour Party have had briefings against them. You'll know that I've not been immune to that. Some of the briefings have absolutely been dripping with misogyny. You know, you hear these things about, we're lazy, we spend too much time with our kids, we don't spend enough time with our kids. You really can't win.
Downing Street's try to combat accusations of a boys' club culture with two women jointly made Sir Keir Starmer's new acting chiefs of staff. However, the Prime Minister's facing a backlash over plans to appoint the first ever female head of the civil service. Sir Keir Starmer wants to replace the Cabinet Secretary, Sir Chris Wormald, with Dame Antonia Romeo. However, the former head of the Foreign Office, Simon McDonald's, issued a highly unusual warning about allegations of bullying and her expenses from when she was a diplomat. The allegations were dismissed by the Cabinet Office at the time. And a former town mayor has been found guilty of helping her son hide evidence when he was arrested for raping a 15-year-old girl. Naheed Hejaz, who was recently the Labour mayor of Bracknell Forest in Berkshire, refused to let officers into her home for over a minute and a half and spoke to her son in Urdu so he could hide his phone. Her 41-year-old son, Diwan Khan, served as the mayor's consort during her time in office. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. We are here until 4 o'clock. Our guest after 3:30 is the best-selling novelist Jenny Godfrey, who has a new book out. It's out today, actually. It's The Barbecue at Number 9. Her debut novel went to number 1 in the bestsellers. This one is set on Live Aid Day in 1985. If you can remember what you were doing and who you were with, you can always let us know on 0333 003 2353. You can remember, can't you?
I was at a schoolmate's, it would have been 18th birthday because it was our A-level summer.
Right.
So we all trogged over from Winchester to Farnham.
What a journey. I mean, you crossed borders.
We did. County lines, Jane. And we had a fantastic day. And it was quite funny, actually, because it started off, you know, being a barbecue outside. But by the end of the party, everybody was just indoors watching Live Aid. It wasn't a party for Live Aid. It was somebody's birthday party. But, you know, what we remember from that day is Live Aid and just how extraordinary it was. Where were you?
I was at a buffet put on by my friend David's mother. And now I look back on that and I think it was really, really generous of her. But at the time, of course, I was a completely self-obsessive 21-year-old who didn't think much of it. Just thought, yeah, why wouldn't the mum put on a buffet? Why should she have done? Anyway, it was a very memorable day, actually. And some of the performances are much, much loved still. And in the course of the interview, we do talk about, because I recorded it earlier, we do talk about Freddie Mercury, and in particular Radio Gaga, and the impact that song had on the crowds at Wembley. I mean, it was really quite an incredible day, that, and it did raise an enormous amount of money. And I know that there have been lots of conversations since about white saviours and all the rest of it, but honestly, at the time, I think we all felt it was a properly good cause and we did want to get involved.
Definitely.
I also appreciate the madness of us all having barbecues and buffets in the circumstances.
Well, very much so. But I think it really is one of those events that, you know, through the long lens of hindsight, we have a very kind of different take on it.
Yeah.
But it enabled, I mean, you and I were very young.
Mm.
It enabled a whole generation to lean into a continent that we were not being taught very much about.
Out,
we weren't
yeah.
seeing very much about. It was a connection. And whether or not it turned out to be a long-lasting good connection is something that, you know, we can intellectualise now. But the emotion that it stirred in people was one of compassion and generosity.
Yeah, it really, really was. It is and remains Proud as a Peacock Thursday.
It does, Jane. Yeah, £250 in a voucher.
In Wix vouchers.
Oh, what a link.
To be won. Get involved. Tell us why you're proud as a peacock on 0333 003 2353. We must move on. It's been quite the week in all sorts of ways, actually. On Monday, we were sitting here fully expecting the Prime Minister to resign. That didn't happen. But there's no doubt the week has been tumultuous for the PM following the fallout of the release of more Epstein files. And now it would seem that President Trump's inner circle is beginning to feel the heat. But despite the fact that President Trump himself is mentioned frequently in the files, it's his old mate and trade secretary, Howard Lutnick, who is now facing calls to resign. Now, the latest files show that the businessman had lunch with the convicted paedophile Epstein on his private island in 2012. This, of course, after Epstein's guilty plea for soliciting a minor. Let's go to Washington and check in with Katie Balls, Washington editor at The Times and The Sunday Times. Tell us, Katie, about Howard Lutnick, because he had been actually very public and very, very vociferous in his horror at the activities of Epstein.
Yes, in various interviews, but the one that particularly comes to mind is an interview last year to a podcast by the New York Post. And he told the interviewer effectively that he had been so disgusted at what he saw at Jeffrey Epstein's house in New York. He was a neighbor. He had a neighboring house to Jeffrey Epstein after a visit in 2005 that he had made a decision there and then after Jeffrey Epstein allegedly told him that he has a massage every day and the right kind of massage, that he had thereby decided to cut off contact professionally, socially, all contact. Then, of course, we get the latest and perhaps final tranche of Epstein files, 3 million files. And in those are various correspondences and now an admission by him that despite saying this, he actually went to Epstein Island and saw Jeffrey Epstein for lunch with his wife and children. And as you know, in 2011, 2012, which is, of course, I think 2011, which is, of course, after Epstein's first guilty plea and conviction.
Right. I mean, it wasn't just his wife and children, but a number of nannies, which I suppose the inclusion of that detail tells us at least that the children were young enough to require nannies. Most of us wouldn't have taken our children to have lunch with that man at that time. Is he not being heavily criticised for that?
He is. And you've even had some Republicans, which I think is a key thing in terms of the political pressure to look at. So Nancy Mace, a Republican, an independently minded Republican, has said exactly what you just said, which is it wouldn't be her judgment to take the kids for lunch with Jeffrey Epstein, nannies or not. But this is certainly, I think it's been interesting being in DC, but obviously having spent a lot of time covering British politics, to see how these Epstein files are causing, you know, chaos, changing the establishment, the royals' business, Keir Starmer's future potentially in the UK. But here in the US, I think it's been fairly muted, the effect on US politics. It's being spoken about, but the reverberations are not the same. And I think the calls for Howard Lutnick to go are probably the closest we've got to a political scandal on it. I mean, that's not to say he is going anywhere, though.
Well, no, and that's the interesting point, isn't it? I was going to ask you whether it might be considered that Howard Lutnick does go, sacrifices himself to take the heat off, shall we say, other people?
Yeah, there's no indication as of yet. We had, the Republicans speaking out are those who are seen by the White House and the administration as the ones that are not loyal enough as it is. I think some Republicans are privately unhappy about the situation and raising questions, but the White House has said they are fully behind him. Howard Lutnick is an old friend of Donald Trump's. And I think there's also probably a feeling that ousting Howard Lutnick, whether if he chose to go, wouldn't necessarily be helpful, because then it would probably move on to another target and perhaps there'd be more questions about Donald Trump's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. Now, Donald Trump says he is completely exonerated by these files. They show that he raised concerns about Jeffrey Epstein in the past, but I think it's, there's a feeling of, if you let one person go, where does that leave in terms of other associates, people who are in these files?
I know that in the files, allegedly, Donald Trump called the local police chief and referenced his concerns about Epstein. But lately, he has gone public and said he didn't know anything about Epstein's reputation. I mean, which version might be true?
Yeah, as you say, when this file, and it's because there are so many files, every day we're still getting new details. When this emerged, which suggested that Donald Trump had spoken his relief that the police were looking into Epstein, saying everyone knows what he's doing, there have been two ways to looking at it, and it tends to be where you sit in the media. So one side is saying, well, he said he didn't know everything, and this shows he did. But then you have the Republicans saying, well, even if he was a bit loose with the truth there, it does corroborate other stories we've heard, which is, you know, there was a point in that friendship where Donald Trump cut off contact. So perhaps he didn't say everything, but I think there is a recurring theme in these files, which is the figures who I think are facing the trickiest questions across the divide are those who kept contact after Jeffrey Epstein's first guilty plea and conviction. Howard Lutnick is in that group. At the moment, Donald Trump is not in that group. And I think that is how people in DC are at least looking at it in terms of the pressure on both.
All right, so he can go on claiming to be exonerated, but actually that is a claim he can make, but it isn't necessarily true, is it?
Well, they clearly has a friendship with Jeffrey Epstein, and there are different accounts of what he said. And if he said he didn't know everything and there's a file saying he did, that's a question for him. But I think that if you do look at the specific questions and those most facing the most serious ones, it is clearly, if you're going to rank it in terms of who faces the biggest question on the Epstein files, the biggest questions are for those who continue to associate with a man after a guilty plea. And they can say, as is the case of Peter Mandelson, for example, oh, it was a terrible mistake, I shouldn't have believed him, I was naive. But that's where I think the real questions of judgment. But I think the whole files obviously raise questions for an entire establishment, particularly if you were rich and powerful in the 90s who associated with this man. And there clearly were telltale signs before that conviction too.
I don't know, I'm sure you did watch the Attorney General Pam Bondi's appearance before the House Judiciary Committee yesterday. Her demeanour is always pretty extraordinary to British eyes, I have to say. But yesterday, I thought she was particularly dire. I think she accused one Democrat of being a washed-up loser lawyer. It didn't really scream, "We've got nothing to hide." What do you think?
Yeah, so it was a 5-hour hearing. I watched a lot of it. I think a few minutes probably went missing in that period. But I think clearly Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, went in deciding attack was the best form of defence. And therefore, we had a 5-hour appearance where I actually learned very little. And I think you had victims sat in the room who spoke of their unhappiness with the Attorney General's responses. She was asked to apologise. But I think she clearly didn't want to answer questions because they decided it was politically loaded. You also had members of the committee, I think, using it to have, you know, their own pantomime monologue moments. And I think the whole thing was probably a missed opportunity in terms of learning or finding out more, for example, about redactions, what's going next with the files. The DOJ has admitted to some errors in its handling of the Epstein files, but Pam Bondi didn't repeat some of those admittances in that hearing. But I think it speaks to how in America it's become very politically charged, the Epstein files. So in the UK you have a situation where the figures in it, I think, are facing greater repercussions than the figures in it in America, broadly speaking. But it's also falling less along political lines. Mm. Everyone is condemning it. Here, the way that the committee has worked, and that is the reason these files have been released, Congress having that act. Often it is the Democrats who will push one thing, so they will go after the Republicans, Donald Trump and others, and then the Republicans will focus on figures like Bill Clinton in it. And it's meant that it becomes really, a match of political point scoring.
Sure.
A lot of the time, rather than working out what actually we need to know about kind of, are more people going to be prosecuted? What is the DOJ doing on that? And when it comes to the Epstein victims, one of the reasons so many names are redacted is that we understand that Epstein often would have these victims who were, under 18. But when they hit 18, he would get them to go and bring their friends in who were younger. So sometimes the victims are also the perpetrators, which is another complication in getting these files out. But a lot of that is lost in the noise.
Right. Do we have a date yet for the Clintons testifying?
Yes, so we're expecting it at the end of the month. It's separate days, so they will have separate appearances as we currently understand it. And both Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton are pushing for this to be a public hearing, but we're not currently you know, that's not something that the Republicans are resisting, partly because it would, of course, set a precedent if you then had senior Republicans compelled to go and speak before the committee in the future.
OK, and a very, very quick reference, if you don't mind, Katie, to this incredible story about the disappearance of Nancy Guthrie, whose daughter is a very famous US news anchor. Is there still no sign of this poor lady?
There's still no sign. There are new leads, of course. The biggest development, I think, is this story is gripping America. It is leading the news bulletins. It's not Jeffrey Epstein's scandal, really. It is this story that you see everywhere. And there has been a development in the sense that there is CCTV footage of, you know, what appears to be the perpetrator in a balaclava that was released earlier this week. There are now lots of tips, tens of thousands going in. There's potentially finding bits of evidence, but still no sign. And I think, you know, it's good the tips are coming in, but if you have tens of thousands, how do you get through them? And with every day, obviously, people grow more concerned that this is going to have at the end that people want to see.
Yeah, depressing. Thank you very much indeed, Katie. And if you'd like to hear more from Katie Balls, you can listen to her on her excellent podcast, The State of It USA. It's available wherever you get your podcasts from.
Now, coming up in a couple of moments' time, more of your nominations for Wicks Proud as a Peacock Awards for this week. And also, could Manchester United's owner be ruled to have brought football into disrepute? We'll talk about that with the mighty Vassos Alexander. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wicks. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wicks.co.uk or visit your local Wicks store.
The State of It USA is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times that brings you real truth about US politics and power. Join political heavyweights Katie Balls and Gerard Baker as they take a deep dive into the latest wrangles in the White House and bring you intelligent analysis and insight.
I went out on the road this week with the First Lady and we rode back in the motorcade.
No fake news, no flag waving and no Trump derangement syndrome. Just the inside track on the decisions that are shaping America. The State of It USA is available now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
Romantic retreats, luxury beachfront hotels, expansive family villas with sensational sea views. Not lots of, just the very best of. Simpson Travel, the magical destinations you love, the personal service you expect. We visit every one of our properties so we can handpick the perfect holiday for you. SimpsonTravel.com, because your time is precious.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wicks Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wicks.co.uk.
Let's do some Wicks nominations, Jane.
Well, she tries every week and she's back. It's Kyra Cooper. I'm proud that my offer's been accepted on a property. I'm going to be living alone for the first time. I do feel a bit daunted, but I'm excited, even with all the DIY jobs that need doing. Have you heard that one before?
I have. But, you know, God loves a trier.
No,
and
absolutely.
We very much love Kyra.
Well done,
so,
Kyra.
You know, one day.
And very briefly from Diane, I'm proud of my wonderful husband, Laurie, who's worked hard throughout his life and conquered many difficulties along the way. He's shown tremendous kindness to so many people and he's adored me, his wife, his daughters and his grandchildren. I'm proud of him every day, says Diane, about a man who just sounds lovely called Laurie.
And Kakpa, and I hope I've pronounced that correctly, for me, my proud as a peacock moment was getting my British citizenship. I'm from Poland. I graduated from the University of Leicester. I really love British culture, Yorkshire tea, scones, pubs and football, and I listen to Times Radio every day. I have many British friends and I now feel as much British as I feel Polish. In the current climate, there's a lot of talk about immigration. It's often focusing on the horror stories which undoubtedly happen, but there are plenty of people who moved to the UK and got integrated in the British culture, and I believe such stories could help in giving people a perspective on immigration.
Thank you very much for that. You can send us a WhatsApp as well, 0333 003 2353, or ping us an email, janeandfee@times.radio. The winner will be announced at the end of the show. That Wicks kitchen and bathroom sale is on. Explore all the sale offers at wicks.co.uk or go to your showroom. It'll be local. You can guarantee there'll be a local one, and it's your Wicks store you want.
Now, the Football Association is investigating whether to charge Manchester United's co-owner, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, with bringing the game into disrepute. Ratcliffe said Britain had been colonised by immigrants in an interview he gave to Sky News. The comments have been labelled offensive and wrong by the Prime Minister. Mr Ratcliffe has now said he's sorry that his choice of language has offended some people. Vassos Alexander joins us in our daily sports slot. Vassos, just tell us a little bit about Jim Ratcliffe. He delivered this message from Monaco, where he now resides. He is a very, very wealthy man. How did he get there?
Well, from Manchester, where his, you know, where his roots are, in a council flat. His dad was a joiner. It's funny when people like Sir Jim Ratcliffe, who's been certainly on, you know, us sporting journalists' radar for a long time, and he was a few years ago top of the Times Rich List, wasn't he? And he's now down to seventh with 17 billion or so in his bank account. But then he says something like this, and I sort of look into to what he's like, how he got to where he did. And, you know, he company hopped and then founded Ineos. And like my mobile phone here has probably got some Ineos products in it. It's a very, very successful company. He's always been a fan of Manchester United and took a minority stake, but he's the guy in charge of running them day to day. A few years ago, he's made some 450 redundancies. And a few years ago, he made the decision to move to Monaco, we presume, for tax reasons.
I mean, to use the word colonisation is tricky, if you wanted to put it mildly. It's not a word that crops up without causing some offence. Does he have any kind of form? I mean, politically, he's a Brexiteer, isn't he?
He was a Brexiteer pre-Brexit. And then before the last general election, he went on the record to say that he supports a Labour government. And then during that interview with Sky, he went on to say that, you know, Nigel Farage was, I think the quote was, a very intelligent man. Nigel Farage has come out in broadly in support of the comments that Sir Jim Ratcliffe made yesterday. And like you say, he has apologised. He has said, quotes, "I'm sorry that my choice of language has offended some people, but it's important to raise the issue of controlled and well-managed immigration that supports economic growth."
Yep. Being a Brexiteer doesn't make anybody racist. Talking about colonisation doesn't necessarily make you racist. But if you get to the point where people believe that you've said something that is inflammatory, is it really an apology if you then say that you are sorry for the people who are feeling offended, but you don't actually retract what it is that you said that causes that? Do you know what I mean?
It does sound a little bit like having a row with one of my teenagers.
Yes, okay.
I'm sorry you're upset about this.
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't
it? Sorry, are you sorry, or are you sorry that I'm upset? So look, the FA are looking into this and whether it does, you know, like you say, a word like colonisation, you know, that is a very interesting choice of word, isn't it? So they are looking as to whether, I mean, it's rule, I had a look into this rule, E3.1. He's obviously, as a co-owner and the man who runs Manchester United, he is a participant in football, and a participant shall at all times act in the best interests of the game and shall not act in any manner which is improper or brings the game into disrepute. So I guess the FA are now looking into the fact, as to whether they're going to judge whether he was just expressing political views or whether those comments crossed the line.
Yeah. Andy Burnham.
Andy Mayer.
The mayor. He's living and breathing it. He's changed his name. Andy Burnham. So he has immediately taken the position that it's wrong, and he's tried to calm things down. He's tried to say calling for curbs on immigration is one thing, but portraying those who come here as a hostile invading force is quite another. He went on to say it's inaccurate, insulting, inflammatory and should be withdrawn. He did have a bit of a dig at the Glazer family while he was up there, didn't he? If any criticism is needed, it should be directed towards those who've offered little contribution to our life here and have instead spent years siphoning wealth out of our proudest institutions. Boof, there we go. But as many people have said, he has got the job of trying to make sure that this doesn't go off into something, because there's so much investment around Old Trafford at the moment. There are so many people who are upset today by it. I mean, he had to come out and say something quite bold.
And he's absolutely key, his involvement in the new Old Trafford project. It was only last month that the Old Trafford Regeneration, it's actually called the Regeneration Mayoral Development Corporation, which was launched, which by 2030 is set to deliver a new 100,000-seater stadium, in Trafford, in this sort of 370-acre site with 15,000 new homes, 50,000 jobs. You know, he's absolutely key in all of this. So certainly Jim Ratcliffe, who wants this to happen, doesn't want to, make any enemies with Andy Burnham.
Yep. A lot of people have also said, gosh, I mean, if you're the co-owner of a mighty, mighty football club, you know the dangers of racism in football. You know what can happen on the pitch. You know what the players might have to endure. And it's a good point, isn't it?
And have endured over many decades. You know, there are still active and needing to be active groups in football. Kick it out, show racism the red card. They've all had their say on this, and they've all absolutely condemned those comments by Sir Jim Ratcliffe. Yes, football is just, it's one of those areas of society that still has a racism problem. And if you are working in football, perhaps, you might want to think twice before using words like colonised by immigrants.
Has the FA given any indication as to when it might make some kind of further statement or decision?
No, they haven't. They have. I mean, the Times have been in touch, and Manchester United haven't made any further statement either. The Times Sports section downstairs, I just talked to James, the head of sport. They've been in touch, and they are, they said, look, we don't want to say too much. It's with the lawyers. We are judging whether, to bring a case against Jim Ratcliffe under that rule, bringing the game into disrepute. Looking historically, they find it quite difficult to do. The last one I could think of was Nicholas Anelka, who was then playing for West Brom, made a gesture called the querelle in France, sometimes called the sort of inverted Nazi salute, which he insists was just in support of a friend of his, a French comedian, and was nothing to do with, anti-Semitism or anything. But he got banned for five games.
Right, OK.
Well, most likely to be a fine, by the way, if they do find Jim Ratcliffe guilty of anything, most likely to be a sort of punitive fine.
Watch this space. Times exclusive this morning about the future of England's manager. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so this is Thomas Tuchel. We were only talking about him last week, that he'd only signed a contract to win us the World Cup in 2026. He's now signed a two-year extension. 8 o'clock this morning, the Times broke the story. And actually, the two stories are sort of related, because there was lots of noise around Thomas Tuchel becoming Manchester United manager. And as we understand it, the Old Trafford hierarchy did want to speak to him about taking over at the end of the season with Michael Carrick in temporary charge. But he's put paid to all of that. Manchester United will be not that happy to hear that he's now signed a two-year extension to take us through to the end of the men's Euros in 2028,
I don't want to be negative. I'm glad they're in that here, and I'm looking forward to them already. But what if England get knocked out in the quarterfinals of the World Cup?
Well,
And Thomas Tuchel, everybody goes, "I've got to sack the manager."
And he makes some clearly terrible substitutions during the
match.
I'm
not saying he will, but...
Yes, that is the risk that the FA are taking.
They rate him then, clearly.
They really do rate him. And he's called it his dream job. He said he didn't have to think twice before signing a contract. Essentially, he absolutely loves it. He thinks it's a great fit for himself. He does want to come back to the Premier League, but at the moment, he's really happy managing England. And his competitive record, played 8-1-8. And he does, he does have a track record as a winner, and that's why he was hired. So let's keep the faith, Jane.
Oh, no, I'm full of faith.
But if he was absolutely, absolutely dreadful and Jane's doom-laden scenario comes true...
Not at all. I'm having a barbecue on World Cup final day, July the 19th. I mean, come round.
What difference would today's extension of his contract make? I mean, you'd sack him anyway.
Absolutely. Ask Sean Dyche at Nottingham Forest, who just got sacked today, and another Premier League manager goes, and they are now, Forest, about to report to appoint Vitor Pereira as their fourth permanent manager this season. Yes, the job of a football manager, as we discussed yesterday, actually, is not the most sort of secure of employment.
George says, quarterfinals, group stages more like. Yeah. Is George north
the
of
spirit.
The border? Well, how far will Scotland go? That's another question. Yes, that is the spirit. It's very much the spirit.
And what? Let me bring you news of an imminent Winter Olympics gold medal for Team GB.
Because we're getting desperate for you.
Yes, yeah. So Matt Western, after the first two of four skeleton runs, is miles ahead of the field. Oh, like, skeleton medals are won by hundredths of a second. He's a third of a second clear of everyone at the halfway stage. Okay. So barring, you know, accidents, he will win gold for us tomorrow.
Okay, so he could still mess it up.
Yeah, no, he could, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Vassos. Lovely to see you. Thank see you next week.
See you next week.
No, I feel the gold in my waters. It's coming, Fee. It's coming.
No, we don't want any more Mystic Garve, because Mystic Garve's always just a little bit off kilter.
Yeah, she's very rarely right, but she keeps trying. You are with Times Radio, and in a moment we're going to be joined by the best-selling author, Jenny Godfrey, who has a new novel out called The Barbecue at Number 9. First, we'll check on the latest news headlines. Here is Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Sakir Starmer has apologised for his choice of language in saying the UK has been colonised by immigrants. The INEOS founder says he knows he's offended some people, but insists it's important he raises the issue of immigration. The FA is now assessing whether the Manchester United owner has brought football into disrepute. Jay Motti is a United fan who runs a podcast.
I'd urge him to come back to Manchester, look around. It's a wonderful, diverse city, and I don't think it's been colonised by immigrants or anyone, to be honest with you. I think he's talking nonsense. I think he quoted numbers that were inaccurate. The language that he used was wrong as well. And it just gave you sort of granddad's had too much sherry at Christmas sort of energy.
A judge in Florida has rejected a BBC application to block Donald Trump's $10 billion Panorama libel case. The two-week trial has been set for next February. The corporation has previously suggested it will fight the case. A paedophile who works in a nursery where he sexually abused and secretly filmed children has been sentenced to 18 years in prison. Vincent Chan has admitted 56 offences, including child sexual abuse. And police have named a 15-year-old boy who murdered a 12-year-old in a random knife attack in Birmingham last year. Kian Moulton killed Leo Ross, who was on his way home from school, after pushing three pensioners to the ground in a spate of attacks. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your new service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
If you could sail anywhere in the world, where would you go? With Oceania Cruises, our small, luxurious ships allow us to dock in boutique ports in 600 stunning destinations. We offer a more immersive experience and a personalized service, creating unique travel memories. From the Caribbean to the Mediterranean and the finest cuisine at sea, it can only be Oceania Cruises. Visit OceaniaCruises.com or your travel agent.
The day's big stories and tomorrow's front pages. Saturday and Sunday nights from 10 with Daryl Morris.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wickes. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
And we'll get to your proud as a peacock moments before 4 o'clock, I promise. 25 minutes to. Now, what is it like to be waiting for your second novel to be published when your debut went to number one? Let's find out from our guest, Jenny Godfrey, author of the best-selling The List of Suspicious Things. You may well have read it. It featured two schoolgirls, Miv and Sharon, trying to track down the serial killer, Peter Sutcliffe. Jenny's new book is The Barbecue at Number 9. It's published today, and it's set in a suburban close on Live Aid Day in the July of 1985.
Radio.
The great Freddie Mercury had the audience at Wembley Stadium in the palm of his hand that day. I think that was probably the song from Live Aid 1985. So Jenny Godfrey's book is set on that day in a suburban close. She doesn't actually say where it is, but it's very much somewhere in England. I asked her how she was feeling about the publication of her second novel.
Somebody actually asked me yesterday how I was dealing with the pressure, and I think they were expecting me to say, oh, I'm fine, I'm very chilled out, and I am not. I am not in the slightest bit chilled out, and I'm owning that. I'm owning the anxiety about my second book.
Why? Why is it so bad? Because of the success of the first?
Yeah, I think so. But also, it's the difficult second album syndrome. And you never know how people are going to react to your words and your stories. But after having such an enormously positive response to the list of suspicious things, I think I just feel really nervous about letting readers and fans of the book down. I mean, I'm an anxious person anyway. So, you know, this just helps the extra pressure.
Yeah, you've picked a strange life path for someone who's a little anxious. Yeah, I mean, you are putting pressure on yourself. Okay. I loved it, so I don't think you've got any worries. I think you're going to be all right.
Thank you.
It is just worth saying that you only became a professional full-time writer relatively recently. You'd had a life, hadn't you?
Yes, I had had a life. I was a corporate person. I worked in HR for 25 years. In fact, I was interviewed in this very building to be the HR director for this company. Yes, I was.
You didn't get it.
They actually stopped recruiting for it.
Right.
I really wanted it.
Oh.
But anyway, we'll probably have to cut that out.
No, we'll keep it in. It's golden.
But yes, so I had a what I now term as a proper job.
Yeah.
Until I gave it all up and started to write at age 49.
And during those years when you were doing something else, something very important, and clearly at a high level, as you indicate, were you reading? Were you writing? Oh, were you obsessing about... Yeah.
So I didn't write, interestingly, but I have always been a voracious reader, like a really serious bookworm. I always tell the story of my mum took me to the doctors when I was about 8 or 9 years old to say, I'm really worried my child is reading too much and not sleeping enough. The doctor said she didn't have anything to worry about. And that has continued, that kind of being a voracious reader. So I feel like my apprenticeship as a writer was served by the many, many, many books I've read.
Okay, that's really interesting. I mean, like you, I love reading and I will read pretty much anything. And I struggle a bit with the so-called literary fiction sometimes, but I'll press on. But there's nothing like getting lost in a book. Are you worried that that absolute bliss potentially is going to be denied to so many generations of our young people?
Yeah, actually, it is a big worry of mine. And I saw my godchildren who are in their early teens last week, and they call me Auntie Jen Jen. And they were like, Auntie Jen Jen, why does English have to be on the syllabus at schools? And I went into some big, enormous rants about critical thinking and empathy. I mean, I'm not sure they were convinced, but I really worry about the generation coming through and the ability to focus actually on reading as much as anything else.
And losing yourself in the lives of others. It's bliss, but it also educates you, obviously.
Yeah, and it's enormously powerful in building emotional muscle, I think.
Let's talk about this new book, because it's set in a very specific time and place. And if you're my age, you're younger, you're only in your 50s. we also, though, remember the day, which is the 13th of July, mm-hmm. 1985.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Margaret Thatcher's Britain. She's very much in her pomp. And we'll get onto her in a moment. But take us through your memories of what you were doing on that day.
So Live Aid, it's actually, for me, impossible to overstate how much it took over the entire country. I was so excited about it. And I was 15 years old. And I had a little black and white portable television in my bedroom. Yeah. And because my parents were quite strict and they didn't like pop music. I watched it on my portable television in my bedroom, but with the landline sort of roped into my bedroom so I could phone my best friend after each act and we could discuss what we thought of them. And one of my biggest memories of the day was after Queen, because as a 15-year-old, Queen were not cool. No. That was kind of dad music.
Yeah, very much so.
But Freddie Mercury was so magical and so magnetic. I remember ringing my best friend and crying down the phone because it was such a uniting, emotional, magical moment. And that's definitely reflected in the book. That's the one time in the book that everyone stops to watch the concert.
I would urge anyone who wasn't around at the time or just has forgotten, go on YouTube. I did it myself.
Yes.
I looked up Freddie Mercury, Live Aid, Radio Gaga, you'll cry.
Yes.
Because it's a man absolutely in control of an amazing situation and atmosphere and riding it out.
I've got goosebumps now.
Yeah, I know, so have I. you've got to see it. He's got tight white jeans and a white singlet on. He looks incredible. Mm. He sounds incredible. And the crowd are singing along with him. And it's honestly life-changing, potentially.
Yeah.
So give yourself a dose of that if you're having a bad week.
Yes.
Delmont Close. That's right. So we are in Berbia.
Yeah.
Very much so. And the couple having the barbecue, they've invited everybody in the close to come along. Not everybody comes. And they are Lydia and Peter. Now, Lydia is, well, she's someone who hugely admires Delia Smith, and who doesn't, and Princess Di.
She absolutely does. And she aspires to be Crystal Carrington from Dynasty.
Well, I mean, I did as well. I definitely had the shoulder pad. I think I'm now more Delia Smith, very much so. Actually, I was then as well. No shade on Delia, who's obviously a genius. Tell us about Lydia, because I can recognise her. She's a character from my youth, actually. Nothing wrong with it, but the aspirational, slightly snooty, slightly vulnerable suburban lady.
Absolutely. And she is inspired by a mum when I was growing up, who, when I used to go to my friend's house and watch television, because that's what you did, when we sat on the sofa, when we would stand up to go, I would be going, she would immediately, before my bum was even off the seat, be coming round to plump the cushions
up. Yeah.
And I've never forgotten that. I used to think it was really funny, but also that it looked like really hard work. And she's absolutely who Lydia is based on.
She is keeping up appearances.
All the way.
But there's a lot she doesn't know, even about her own family.
Yes. And I guess, you know, not to make too many parallels to today, but it's kind of Instagram versus reality, but 80s style.
Yeah.
You know, she wants her house to be perfect and she wants the appearance of the perfect family. But of course, underneath that is a lot of imperfection and some secrets that she learns throughout the course of that 12 hours.
Yes, she goes on a journey.
She certainly does. I love her, by the way.
Yeah, I think I wonder if this could be televised. And I wonder who you would have in the role of Lydia. Who would it be?
Do you know what? I don't know. But I think Alison Steadman's a little older now. But she would have been my ideal.
Yeah, okay, that's a really good reference. I'll absolutely take that.
Yeah.
Now, her husband, it's not a spoiler to say that he is someone who's under a great deal of strain.
No.
And he is going out to work, or so we think.
Yes.
But he's not, is he?
No, and that is a story that I sort of remember from that time.
Well, I don't want to interrupt, but I know someone whose dad did that.
Oh, my God, really?
Well, somebody I was at university with, her dad used to go to the library every day.
Oh, my gosh, that's actually made me a bit sad.
Well, because
it is true, though. It
absolutely is. This is the 1980s. People were losing their jobs.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And of course, our focus as a country was on this kind of homeowning, you know, self-made man, particularly men, self-made man. But that's not sustainable for everyone. And we were about to go into a huge recession. And I sort of wanted to capture that tension in the character of Peter.
Yeah, well, you do, and you end up feeling really sorry for this man. And indeed, even his teenage daughter feels sorry for him too by the end.
Stephen Mangan is reading him in the audiobook.
Oh, everybody.
How perfect is that?
Everyone's in for a treat.
Yeah.
There's a character called Steve.
Yes.
Who is, again, a vulnerable person. It's all about, actually, what goes on behind the neck curtains of suburbia, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
You can
yeah.
wash them in your glow white as often as you like.
Yeah.
But you can never really protect yourself from reality.
Yeah.
And Steve is someone who served in the Falklands.
Yes, and if there's any character that I did intense research around, it's Steve. Because I feel like the Falklands is almost a forgotten story, and particularly the experience of veterans in the Falklands. So I did a lot of reading of first-person accounts, particularly of young soldiers who were part of that combat. I learned such an enormous amount, but I loved writing that character to represent a story I don't think is often told.
No, it isn't, and it should be. You're right. And I'm just trying to think who else we've missed out. Well, there's Rita, who's she's a divorcee. She's a little bit suspicious. I mean, Lydia is certainly very suspicious of Rita. And she does have a backstory, and we find out exactly what it
yes.
is. she's not quite everything she seems to be.
No.
But, I mean, do you think that is just the reality of suburban life? Perhaps the life of any street, actually.
Yes, I really do. I absolutely do. And when you said about kind of Steve being vulnerable, I think we're all vulnerable in our different ways. And, you know, I wanted to write a book that showed empathy for everyone's stories, from Lydia to Steve, but also the kind of breadth of human life. Because my family actually did move from the north to the south, fate worse than death, when I was 10 years old or 11 years old, and we moved to a new build, Wimpey Estate. And there's all that tension when you're moving somewhere like that of appearing to be a certain way to your neighbours, appearing to be something in your community. And I love the idea of reflecting that in this novel.
You have written, and I hope you don't mind me mentioning that this, in your Substack about family estrangement.
Yes.
And again, it's something we don't often discuss, but
no.
None of us have perfect families. None of us have seamless relations with our nearest and dearest. It just doesn't happen. But I must admit, I had not read anything quite as, well, soul-bearing and honest as your story of what's gone on in your family.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that you should bring that up, because I started that Substack basically when I was frozen with fear after the success of The List of Suspicious Things and couldn't write novels until I had the idea for The Barbecue at Number 9. But I started that Substack as a way of getting me writing again. But it's become much more of a writing about the reality of life as a middle-aged woman in a way that I don't censor myself, because I think it's really important to reflect life honestly.
Yeah.
And the whole Instagram versus reality worries me for young people, but worries me for middle-aged women too.
Yeah, if we all really think everyone's having as good a time as they purport to be having,
yes,
I'd be really, really more anxious than I already am. But, I mean, you have said, that your father was actually estranged from his family, wasn't
yes.
he?
Yes.
And you at one point met your dad in the street but hadn't seen him for a decade.
Yes, I bumped into him in a shopping mall on Christmas Eve and he didn't recognise me. And I just automatically said, Dad, I hadn't seen him for that length of time either. And we went for a cup of tea in Woolworths in Milton Keynes. And that was the first time we'd seen each other in, at least 10 years. And that was the beginning of us reforming a relationship. And I've always been obsessed with kind of families. I guess, I mean, it's no surprise given my own background.
Yeah.
And in what happens within families. And I guess part of my writing journey as a novelist is about exploring the imperfection of families, but with hopefully a little bit of hope about the future.
Well, this is a hopeful book.
good.
I mean, it does end. I don't want to give anything away, but it ends on some positive notes.
Yeah. Which we all need right now.
well, we do, and it is a grim time. Mm. And I wonder, you've tackled the Thatcher years in the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher, as we should call her, for balance. Because it is worth saying that lots of people voted for her and continue, and she won three elections.
Yes,
I mean that's true.
Yes.
But before that, you'd done the years of the serial killer Peter Sutcliffe and the impact on a whole generation of people, not just young women.
Yes.
Are you going to move forward in time with your next one?
I certainly am.
Is it in space?
It's actually in 1997.
Oh, now that was also a big year.
Enormous year.
Quite a lot happened that year.
Absolutely. And so this book, The Barbecue at Number 9, is set over the 12 hours of Live Aid. My third book is set over the 12 months of 1997, because so much happened in that year. And it's entirely through the lens of one family. So I'm getting deep into the family relationships on book three.
I'm looking forward to that one already.
Is it Chris Patten's family and the handover of Hong Kong?
Yes, it'll be that. We're very much at the centre of the new book, I'm sure. Jenny Godfrey was the author in conversation there. The Barbecue at Number 9 is out today. And Natalie, on the strength of that conversation, has already gone and bought it. So I'm sure Jenny will be delighted. And we've got lots of messages actually about Live Aid. John says, I listened to Live Aid on the radio whilst lying on my back in my parents' driveway, painting the chassis of my first car. Which had been made back in 1966. I still have that car, so I guess the painting worked. But there is a part of me that wishes I'd actually watched it rather than listened to it on the radio. Kate says, I'm 57. I remember Live Aid vividly, though I did miss the first half. Well, get this. We had to go to the ordination of our parish curate. Catholic upbringing, she says. The following year, I did see Queen at Wembley Stadium and they were absolutely brilliant. And Greg says, actually, girls, that's us, Fee, the best performance at Live Aid was David Bowie with Heroes. I actually don't remember that. I'm very sorry. But Greg, thank you. This is a good email from Angie. My seven-year-old daughter and I, back in 85, managed to take the TV out of our North London back garden, into our North London back garden, on a long extension lead, so we could watch it all outdoors. As Bob Geldof began to speak, our lovely Spanish neighbour leaned over the fence and said, "Who's that long-haired, scruffy bloke? I drove him to Wembley at 4 o'clock this morning." I always thought it was rather charming that this delightful chauffeur hadn't realised that his passenger had been the most famous man on the planet that day. It's extraordinary, isn't it? But sometimes, I suppose you just don't know. You just do the job. You're a driver. You've got to get someone somewhere and you do it.
You would have thought that there'd been some elements
a
to tell him.
you might have
he
said.
He was on his way to a big event. Yeah. I wouldn't have thought the traffic around Wembley was particularly easy that day. Are we doing the Wick stuff now or do we have some kind of a functional thing? We'll take the break. Let's take the break.
Here we go.
Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald on Times Radio Breakfast with Visit Scotland. Discover Times Radio's essential weekend briefing, where intelligent conversation meets incisive analysis of all the big stories making the headlines. Exploring the wider news agenda with guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald on Times Radio Breakfast. Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 with Visit Scotland. Start your story in Scotland with visitscotland.com/winter.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
It turns out you can please all of the people, all of the time. Garden games for the kids, a separate cottage for the grandparents, a private chef for that special occasion. Simpson Travel, idyllic Mediterranean holidays that everyone will love. We take care of the details so you can enjoy the moment. SimpsonTravel.com. Because your time is precious.
Global events.
There's a warning that the impact of climate change is getting more severe and we're not prepared.
Breaking news.
Following allegations of potential fraud raised by the Times.
Reactive analysis.
What's going on in the government about discussion of extremism?
From the world's best journalists.
We're trying to look at some of the questions about migration and the implications for the economy, jobs and public services.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
The Wix Peacock Awards on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms. The Wix Kitchen and Bathroom Sale is on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
I know the anticipation may be really hard to bear for you all, so we will bring it to a conclusion. You've got a couple of late entries for the Wix Proud as a Peacock £250 voucher.
Yeah, let's mention, Philippa, I completed 43 out of the 54 mandatory training modules for Barts Hospital in the last 3 days. I have a new job working for Access and I've stuck at it despite death by PowerPoint. I've also learned a lot, says Philippa. And as a bonus, I did the How to Prevent Fraud module, which is actually only meant for the chief exec. So I'm feeling really proud of myself. Well, congratulations. And Neil says he'd like to nominate Ryan, our Ryan, for the Proud as a Peacock Award. It seems like he really does a fantastic job. Not just on your show, but I note that unlike most on Times Radio, he puts in a full day.
Neil, you're very cruel.
Gosh, it cuts to the quick, Neil.
It does, doesn't it? I'm here for at least 4.5 hours. What about you, Jane?
Yeah, a good five on a solid work day. Look, have I ever complained about my working hours? No, I have not. Do I give it everything? Up to a point.
Right, I'm going to award the winner this week to Heather Simmons. Heather says this, I'm proud as a peacock as today I completed my training for the Cancer Research 10K run in London at the weekend. The last time I did one of these runs was 35 years ago. This time I've raised money for cancer research and would love to win the voucher to give to my local hospice so that I can help the hospice continue to help those who are living with cancer and other life-threatening diseases. Heather, we will be in touch. Many congratulations. We run the competition every Thursday. We've still got a month to go, so please don't be disappointed.
We've got 6 weeks to go.
If you are not today's winner, you'll get some other chances.
Yes, you will. You'll get a chance up until the end of March to enter Proud as a Peacock. And it's worth winning. That's the thing about this. And we love reading your entries and hearing about things that you're proud of. You can win that £250 Wix voucher by sending us your proudest moment of the week. Why not get one in early, 0333 003 2353, or email janeandfee@times.radio.
The Wix Peacock Awards on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms. The Wix Kitchen and Bathroom Sale is on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
Let's bring in Paul, who says, once I was in my local swimming pool and I thought, who's that loudmouth Irishman swearing at his kids? I came out of the cubicle and came face to face with Bob Geldof. I said, hello, Bob left. That's quite an anecdote, isn't it?
It is. I was hoping for a little bit of a turn in the plot there, no, but never mind.
That was the whole plot.
It's a very good sighting.
Yes, it is. Right, who do we want to thank? Well, who was our producer today, Fee?
Felix Forbes.
And our technical operator was,
Ryan
as ever.
Boyden.
Yes,
Ryan
it was. It
Ryan
was
Boyden.
The indefatigable and apparently tireless Ryan Boyden, although we should point out he does knock off now. I mean, he's not doing a nice.
Oh, no, do you know what? I'm not going to join in knocking Ryan. He works so blooming hard, Jane.
Yeah. Oh, OK. You can tell Fee's in a holiday mood.
I'm off next week.
She won't be here next week.
I won't be.
I will be. And actually, we've got some interesting guests next week. Among them, Dame Maggie Adairan, astrophysicist. She has an interesting book out called Starchild. And we're also going to be talking to Giselle Pellico's lawyer. Giselle Pellico's memoir, Hymn to Life, is being published very soon. Her lawyer is appearing with us on Times Radio in the afternoon next week. Have a good weekend, and John Pienaar is standing by.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Fee. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar. And this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Sir Jim Ratcliffe has apologised for his choice of language after saying the UK had been colonised by immigrants. And the US President Donald Trump's multi-billion dollar lawsuit against the BBC has been scheduled to go to trial in February 2027. Now, coming up after those Ratcliffe comments, I'm going to be talking to Jed Grebby, Chief Executive of Show Racism the Red Card. And Times Radio's political editor Anna Mihailova joins us, the government publishing its long-awaited trans guidance for schools.
This is Times Radio.
And here's the news with Stuart Willey.
Good afternoon, John. Thank you. The FA is assessing whether Sir Jim Ratcliffe's comments about immigration have brought football into disrepute. The INEOS founder and Manchester United owner has apologised for saying immigrants are colonising the UK. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, condemned those remarks, but defended the government investing in INEOS's Grangemouth plant in central Scotland.
What Jim Ratcliffe said was unacceptable. It was disgusting, frankly. But I'm not going to let what Jim Ratcliffe has said determine the future of jobs in Scotland. It is really important that we invest in our industrial base in Scotland and right across the UK.
The government's announced 1.4 million NHS workers will get a 3.3% pay rise in April. The GMB union says it doesn't make up for what it says was lost pay over more than 10 years. A judge in Florida has dismissed the BBC's bids to block Donald Trump's $10 billion libel case. They've set the trial date for next February. It's over how Panorama edited the president's speech before the January 6th Capitol riot. A paedophile has been sentenced to 18 years in prison for abusing children when working at a nursery in northwest London. Vincent Chan has admitted 56 offences, including child sexual abuse and upskirting women and girls. The judge, John Dodd, says Chan has a deep-seated sexual obsession with children.
Every right-thinking person hearing about your offences would feel revulsion and disbelief. Your conduct was utterly wicked, perverse, and depraved. You became a sexual predator and someone who had clearly lost all sense of moral compass.
A 15-year-old boy who murdered a 12-year-old in a random knife attack in Birmingham has been named. Kian Moulton would usually get an anonymity because he's under the age of 18, but a judge thinks there is public interest in naming him. He murdered Leo Ross, who was on his way home from school after pushing three pensioners to the ground. He's been sentenced to 13 years in prison, which Leo's mother has called a joke. New government guidance will allow children to change their gender at school after their parents are consulted. Teachers will be told to take a very careful approach when allowing children to transition, which can include changing their pronouns or wearing a different uniform. It will say, though, that lavatories and sleeping arrangements on school trips must stay based on sex, not gender. Donald Trump's border czar says the president has agreed to end immigration raids in Minnesota, where two American citizens have been shot dead by officers. And Volodymyr Zelensky has called the International Olympic Committee morally appalling after banning a Ukrainian skeleton athlete. Vladislav Haraskovich was disqualified from the Winter Olympics for wearing a helmet depicting athletes who've been killed by Russia. The IOC president, Kirsty Coventry, was in tears when she spoke about it.
I really wanted to see him race today. It's been an emotional morning. We have these rules in place to try and be fair and also to try and allow for us to do both things, right? To allow for athletes to express themselves, but also to allow for athletes to be safe.
Haraskovich says his disqualification is the price of dignity. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar, at Drive, on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Well, were Jim Ratcliffe's comments offensive? Well, yes, Sir Jim, you saying our country has been colonised by immigrants was offensive. It is, by the way, our country, whether you choose to accept that or not. And I say that as the son of mixed-race South African parents who came to this country in the early 1950s. And as for your apology earlier, saying you're sorry people were offended, well, it wasn't really an apology, was it? It sounded like something in politics they call a non-apology apology. You didn't say you were wrong to suggest people who've come here have been bad for the country. And I'm glad you didn't. You clearly meant what you said. It is a free country and you can say what you like. Just understand that when you do it, you should expect an argument, not about your wild exaggerations about the scale of immigration in recent years and the cost of the economy and welfare. You were just embarrassingly wrong about that. No, an argument from those who understand that the UK is a multiracial, multi-faith society, and it won't change. That there are real problems and real worries among people who see the country they grew up in changing in the way that it has. Expect an argument from people who understand that true integration, it sounds like a lofty ideal, but it's also a vital necessity. Unless you think the answer to that is to round up and forcibly ship hundreds of thousands of legally settled people and their families out of the country. Maybe give a thought to the fact that many, many of us, most of the time, actually do get along really rather well. Language matters. Some language contributes nothing and can make problems worse. But, as I said, you are entitled to your opinion. So let's talk about it. And send me a text. Tell me what you're thinking. 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. As I say, let us talk. Now, as we're hearing in the news, the FA opening an investigation into Manchester United co-owner Sir Jim Ratcliffe. That's after the billionaire told Sky News that Britain had become colonised by immigrants.
I mean, the UK has been colonised. It's costing too much money. It will cause... The UK has been colonised by immigrants, really, isn't it? I mean, the population of the UK was 58 million in 2020. Now it's 70 million...
Well, Sir Jim has released a statement apologising for his choice of language, but he maintains it's right to raise the issue of controlled and well-managed immigration. Martin Ziegler joins us now, live on the line, chief sports reporter for The Times. Hi to you, Martin.
Hey, John, good to be with you.
Great to have you here. Just share your thoughts on this at the moment, Martin.
Well, so I'm out in Brussels where the English FA are for the Nations League draw and the UEFA Congress. Now, I think they were basically, when football's anti-discrimination body Kick It Out released a statement saying these comments by Ratcliffe were disgraceful and divisive, I think they're sort of duty-bound to look into them and see whether they are bringing the game into disrepute, which I think is an interesting... but I think they have to do it, really.
Yeah.
Because it has caused such an uproar within, as you've seen, within football bodies as well as within the sort of general public. And so I think it's going to be an interesting test case to see what they do.
Yeah, well, I guess that's true. And when you say they had to do it, what's your own take on that, Martin?
Well, yeah, I think they do need to look at it because I think it's the language he used. It was pretty horrible, really. It's sort of demonising people. You know, many people who've come to this country legally, been welcomed, and what is he saying exactly? And you mentioned the fact your family were immigrants from South Africa. Obviously, my name, my family were immigrants from Germany a bit further back. So it's there are lots and lots of immigrants. Does he mean people of different colour? What is he actually talking about? So